we're being cautious, conservative, you know, any of those words I think would work to describe the department's approach to Chinook salmon in general.
The state manages Low King runs across Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 4th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, melting creates problems at Denali Base Camp.
Camp is getting really scary. I just had a crevasse open up really close to my tent that I've been walking over.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, providing insight on statewide business and government issues. There's more information online at akbizmag.com.
Alaska state troopers have fatally shot a 19-year-old Palmer man they say was threatening officers with a gun. Troopers say Adrian Spindler died at the scene of the shooting early this morning. Troopers responded to a home after getting a 911 call shortly before 1 a.m., indicating there was a suicidal man with a gun there. Wasilla police also responded. According to the troopers, officers negotiated by phone and in person with Spindler for about an hour. Two women inside left the home safely. Troopers shot Spindler after he exited the home and threatened officers with a gun. The shooting is under investigation. The head of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game Commercial Fisheries Division was in King Salmon recently to check on the Bristol Bay salmon season. KDLG fisheries reporter Melody Kay checked in with Jeff Regnard and asked him about the Chinook salmon declines across the state.
We're being cautious, conservative, you know, any of those words I think would work to describe the department's approach to Chinook salmon in general. You know, we've recognized clearly that we've had a downturn in production, and so we're just going to be that much more careful, meaning it's going to have to be real numbers in season for us to feel that we can have fisheries in some of these cases.
That's Jeff Regnart, the Commercial Fisheries Division Director for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He's talking about the decline in king salmon returns to rivers statewide. The trend isn't new. In 2009 and 2010, the Yukon River was close to commercial king salmon fishing. Last year, there were subsistence and sport fishing restrictions for king salmon on the Nooshogak River. And this year, the start of commercial fishing season in the Nooshogak District was delayed to allow king salmon to make it upriver. Since 2009, early fishing on the Kenai has been restricted due to low king returns. And on Kodiak Island's Karlik River and on the Copper River, this year's run has been weaker than the run size seen in recent years. Regnard said that in southwest Alaska, the decline has been more pronounced in the last few years. Of particular concern in Bristol Bay is the Nooshogak River.
This year, it's still yet to be determined if all gear groups are going to be affected. You know, we've taken some actions in the commercial fishery to try to get fish in the river. The sport fishery has had some impacts to it to try to conserve fish that are in the river. And so we'll just see where we end up.
Unlike the urbanization and development issues that king salmon face in the lower 48, Regnard said he doesn't think that those issues affect numbers in Alaska.
In the major watersheds with the significant Chinook runs, there isn't any work, to my knowledge, being done with habitat improvement, in large part because the habitat hasn't changed in many, many years. We don't think it's an urbanization or we don't have hydroelectric issues. Some of the things that's plagued the Northwest aren't what's going on here. It's likely something in, you know, either the early freshwater phase or marine that's causing, you know, fewer fish to survive to returning adults.
According to Regnart, one sign that king salmon populations might be growing again is sport fishing catch numbers for winter kings in southeast and south central Alaska. Dan Schindler is a research biologist at the University of Washington. He says winter kings are 2 to 3 year old salmon that move to marine regions with more nutritious feed conditions during the winter. And for king salmon from streams and rivers on the west coast of the United States, including Alaska, those marine regions would be the waters of the Gulf of Alaska and west. Here's Regnart again.
True sport fishermen who are out there targeting feeder kings are seeing an abundance that they haven't seen in a long time. And those fish will come back to their natal streams over the next few years. Now, some of them, of course, are going to be, you know, be British Columbia fish, especially in Southeast Alaska. Not all of them would be coming back to Alaska streams. But it's a good thing when British Columbia or Oregon or Washington Kings do well. I mean, it just tells you that hopefully that the ocean conditions are beneficial for kings.
Reporting in King Salmon, this is Miladi Kay.
The doors are now locked on the state's coastal management program. That's the bottom line result of the legislature and governor's action last week in not extending it. Now officials are wondering what it will take to reconstruct a new program to fit into the federal system. Kotzebue's Reggie Jewell, a Democrat who's a member of the majority caucus, began answering that question during a meeting last week of the House Finance Committee.
I watched an issue like this evolve over the issue of subsistence, where the state and people could not come together. And we still haven't. People went to the federal government, and we're under a dual management system of our game resources. I think we run the risk of another entrenchment.
Jewell referred to issues such as endangered species, critical habitat, and wild lands in which the state routinely challenges the federal government. He says the state action is to clear the way for development. Jewell agrees with the administration's idea that Alaska can still voice its opinion on coastal matters, but he says it won't be with the same authority that the Coastal Management Program carries. Attorney General John Burns was at the committee's witness table while Jewell made his comments. In reply, Burns recognized Jewell's look at the future of the program, saying he too is concerned about the polarizing effect of putting the program away. But Burns says he sees an opportunity to rebuild a system that will work.
The state of Alaska, state residents have to work together because in the end, we are all in this together. The decisions that we make have to be made as Alaskans, regardless of ethnicity and geographic location. We have to make decisions in the best interest of the state as a whole.
Jewell told the committee that he is concerned about Alaska losing its reputation in all resource development management questions, especially when it is seen as not being able to manage its coastal issues. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Wrangell celebrates the return of a piece of its history.
One of the elders said, "I have goosebumps on my arms." She said this, and she was brought to tears. She said she never thought that she would see this.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again is making the best decision for herself and her baby. The mother has a better chance of regaining health and energy between pregnancies, and her baby has a better chance of being born on time and at a good weight. Talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Local independent booksellers and First Amendment protection groups are applauding a federal judge's decision against criminalizing the sale of material that could be considered harmful to minors. U.S. District Court Judge Ralph Beistlein, in a decision last week, struck down specific provisions of an Alaska law which makes electronic distribution of indecent material to minors a crime. Beistlein said the law could have a chilling effect on protected speech because there is no way sellers of online materials could know the age of those accessing their communications. Beistlein's decision bars enforcement of that section of Senate Bill 222. The suit was filed last August, and in October of last year, the courts granted a preliminary injunction against enforcement of certain parts of the statute. David Cheesham, co-owner of Fireside Books in Palmer, is one of the plaintiffs in the suit. Cheesham says Thursday's ruling is in line with the preliminary injunction. He said the Alaska law was not possible to comply with because of its requirements.
Either your website or your store clerk to know two things, to know the content of the books, you know, of every book you're selling, and to know the to be able to read the minds of people you're selling the books to know if they are, you know, what their parents want them to read and what their parents don't want them to read.
Although Judge Beislein said the state has a compelling interest to protect minors, he said the government may not reduce the adult population to only what is fit for children. John McKay, an Anchorage attorney who worked on the suit, says the state statute had applied to both in-store and electronic sales.
What the concern is that if you keep the internet to be a vehicle of communicating information that's only fit for children to receive, then that really restricts unnecessarily and inappropriately lots of communications that are entirely legal and appropriate for adults.
McKay says the state statute was aimed at guarding against online child predators.
I think it's the right result. You know, a lot of times, you know, it can be unpopular to say, well, you know, you're defending language that's indecent or inappropriate. But, you know, the First Amendment protects unpopular speech. It protects speech that's not right for everyone. But particularly, as is the case here, to try and limit speech to what's appropriate for children really puts booksellers at risk if they can be held accountable for the contents of every book.
Beislein said that if the state deems additional protections for minors necessary, the legislature can draw up a more narrow statute. Before ruling on the case, the state requested that the federal court ask the Alaska Supreme Court to answer questions about the scope of the statute, but the Alaska Supreme Court declined to answer the questions. Plaintiffs in the suit included the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska, Tidal Wave Books and Bosco's in Anchorage, and the Alaska Library Association. The Denali climbing season is starting to wrap up. There are only a couple hundred people left on the mountain and only a few left to check in at the Talkeetna Ranger Station to start their climbs. With less than 2 weeks left in the regular climbing season, the Kihiltna Glacier has yawning crevices and climbers are being forced to only travel at night. KTNA's Sue Dio has the report on base camp conditions.
A little less than 1,200 people have registered to climb Denali this season. That's about average, at least in recent years. Climbers are still headed up to base camp, even though the majority of climbers are done with their expeditions. For those that are just heading up to base camp, Lisa Roderick is the longest-running base camp manager that the park has seen. She has over a decade of experience on the Kihiltna Glacier and reports poor conditions at base camp.
Camp is getting really scary. I just had a crevasse open up really close to my tent that I've been walking over. I didn't even notice any signs that there was a crevasse there. So some climbers stepped in it last night, and it's a pretty big crevasse, so that's a little scary.
She says there is less snowpack this year, and there's actually dirt blowing off rock faces.
These mountains are completely void of snow on most of their faces. And so, yeah, we're looking at different conditions because of that. That's something I've never really expected to happen is this, dirt to blow around and cause problems on the glacier. If you look down towards the main Kihiltna now, you just see it's just all brown.
The melt has caused issues with glacier travel not far from base camp.
You know, it's like 5 miles of glacier that they have to cross, and there's some pretty bad sections. So a lot of people have been punching in. A lot of people have just been reporting very, very scary conditions. Although in the past, we've had scary conditions before, but I just really think that the way things look down there is something like I've never seen before.
Roderick says scientists who are studying the mountain's glaciers will be examining the dirt to tell her if it's dirt or volcanic ash from a couple of years ago, or both. Brandon Latham is one of the National Park Service climbing rangers that has returned from a patrol. He was on the mountain for a month and saw a variety of conditions.
It did seem that the temperatures were a little bit warmer and there was less accumulation of snow and there was less wind. That was one thing that I noted a lot. Throughout our stay up on the mountain was that the wind was pretty calm compared to most years, although they have had a few pretty big wind events since we've been off the mountain.
He said he had heard reports that somewhere between 15 and 20 people had falls into crevasses, either partial or full falls into the gaping slots in the glacier. And when it was time for his patrol to descend, he saw some of the trouble with his own eyes.
You could see a lot of places where it looks like people with snowshoes had, you know, punched through and broken part of the snow bridge. And a couple of the holes were, you know, you could tell big enough where somebody actually fell down into it.
Roderick seems fairly confident that if the weather holds, that the air taxis will continue to fly climbers in and out.
The planes are dealing with everything pretty good right now. I think that they're going to be able to make it through the climbing season. We have two runways now. We have the main runway that we've been using all season, and then I put another runway in about a mile from my camp. And that runway has actually been holding in really nice, doesn't really have a lot of the dirt problems that the lower strip has.
Although there is a lot of concern about the lower Cahilton Glacier, the rest of the mountain is reported in good shape. Roderick reports that several feet of snow has fallen at both the 14,000-foot camp and the high camp at 17,200 feet. That's a bit of a change from early in the season, when the lack of snow and hard-packed conditions up high contributed to a number of problems. The current summit success rate is 58%, not a record, but one of the highest in the past 10 years. In Talkeetna, I'm Sue Dio.
Alaskan News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com, and by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Juneau's Postal Service will not change. The U.S. Postal Service was considering closing Juneau's mail processing center and transferring its operations to Anchorage, but it's nixed the idea. USPS spokesman Ernie Swanson says officials thought the change would not have a big impact, but in the end decided it wouldn't save enough money to be worthwhile.
Granted, the distance between Juneau and Anchorage is fairly significant, and it can only be done by plane. And there are planes, of course, going back and forth between those two locations all the time, and we have planes carrying mail anyway. But in the final analysis, the Postal Service decided that it just wasn't going to provide the level of financial savings that we were hoping for, and so we decided not to go ahead with it.
An analysis by the Postal Service shows closing the Juneau Processing Center would have saved about $150,000 to $200,000 a year. If the plan had gone forward, any mail going in and out of Juneau would have been routed through Anchorage. Slowly but surely, Southeast Alaska's fledgling aquaculture industry is beginning to take hold. KRBD's Deanna Garrison recently sat down with one of the industry's local pioneers who has been operating an oyster farm in the region since 1980.
Have a good one.
We'll probably see you next week. That's
the sound of a float plane taking off from Kaufman Cove headed for Ketchikan. On the plane are five cases of fresh oysters from the Canoe Lagoon Oyster Farm, which has operated near here since 1980. Proprietor Don Grizz Nicholson was one of the first to attempt commercial oyster farming in Southeast Alaska. Nicholson had worked in the timber and fishing industries prior to arriving in Alaska in 1980, the same year he decided to launch the aquaculture business.
Really, there were no established oyster farms per se. No one had really made a living. Certainly banks wouldn't loan to anybody. They'd go, what? Oyster farming? What's that? And it was sort of new technology anyway. The availability of oyster seed to start a crop and also the equipment to raise oysters. It was all just sort of cutting edge. It just looked like it would be a sort of an opportunity to start on something from the ground floor.
Nicholson has since married Sharon Gray, and the two operate the oyster farm on the remote Blaschke Islands outside of Kaufman Cove. The couple lives in a cabin at the farm site. Each week, they pack up a boat with cases of oysters for a 10-mile trip across Clarence Strait to Kaufman Cove. From there, they distribute their product to local markets on the island and in Ketchikan. Many of their oysters are shipped via airplane to wholesale seafood distributors in the lower 48. Gray says the actual amount of oysters sold each year fluctuates greatly.
If we have a couple of really good growing seasons, we might have 250,000 oysters to sell. On the other hand, if we have a couple of bad growing seasons, we may only have 150,000 oysters to sell. So I've actually had to turn off a few customers, and we've had summers where we've sold 600 to 700 dozen a week.
Gray says the farm averages 250 to 300 dozen oysters a week. That's in part because over the years, the farm's oysters have gained a following.
The colder waters in southeast Alaska produce a very unique, sweet-flavored oyster that people really pick up on. It's something that even non-oyster eaters go, wow, that's actually pretty good.
The oyster farm utilizes Japanese lantern nets attached to logs. The collapsible polyethylene mesh nets have 5 to 10 tiers. Each tier holds oysters. Right before the sale, Gray says the couple spends a lot of time weeding the oysters.
A lot of other critters love setting on the oysters because of their shell, I guess. It's a nice, hard, flat. It's not flat. Yeah, it's a rock.
It's a rock.
And we have tunicates and sponge and barnacles and mussels, etc., etc., and they just set. They're sessile creatures, and they set all over the oysters, and you have to clean them off.
In addition to being one of the longest operating mariculture businesses in southeast Alaska, Canoe Lagoon is doing something that many are not, posting a profit. Nicholson says the profitability of the aquaculture industry in this region is marginal at best.
You can't make very many mistakes, and you certainly can't have a big expensive loan where you're paying interest, and the equipment is very costly.
Nicholson says getting reliable oyster seed is one of his biggest struggles. Well, that and the raucous southeast Alaska storms that roll through each winter. And then there's the predation by starfish, which Nicholson says are voracious shellfish eaters.
I can always tell when I have a sea star in a net because I'll go to pick it up. Instead of weighing 150 pounds, it weighs about 20 pounds. And every mussel, oyster, barnacle is dead. And here in the bottom will be laying this huge fat sea star. It just looks like, I just imagine the Cheshire cat sitting there staring at me. Yep, I ate them all.
Nicholson and Gray say they would do it all again in a heartbeat.
You are so close to the earth, so involved with Mother Earth, you know, and she's a great teacher, let me tell you. But it's so gratifying to be able to create a product that's so good for you, so delicious.
On Prince of Wales Island, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Last month, a piece of Wrangell's history was welcomed home. Wrangell's Cooperative Association threw a parade to celebrate the return of a totem pole created by the late master carver Tom Yukas. KSTK's Charlotte Duran was at the parade and has this report.
To many in the community, Tom Yukas was more than a master carver. He was a Tlingit tribesman, a historian, an elder, a neighbor, and an artist. Yukas lived in Wrangell with his family most of his life, and today many of his creations and totems can still be seen around town. The native community gathered on Front Street to welcome home the totem with traditional Tlingit song and dance. Here are some of the sounds from the parade.
It went wonderful. I can't say enough about it. Everybody showed up in the rain, and we were walking down the street behind the trucks, and one of the elders said, "I have goosebumps on my arms." She said this, and she was brought to tears. She said she never thought that she would see this, and I think this is the only time I've ever seen it in my lifetime.
That's Tribal Office Manager Carol Snoddy. She says the tribal office has been working to bring back traditional Tlingit artwork and artifacts to Wrangell. Leading the parade was Elder Marge Bird. Blackbird is a relative of Yukaos and says the arrival of the totem pole was a great way to kick off a number of tribal-related projects starting this summer.
Going along with what we're working on so hard, our Shakes Island and Carving Shed, and I think it just came at the right time. So that kind of kicked things off, you know, and get everybody excited about things like this. Seeing it, yeah, and seeing that we're all here supporting it.
Once the totem pole arrived downtown, it was on display for most of the afternoon. The public was invited to stop by to view the totem and join in on the festivities at the tribal office. Community member Sue Ramsey led the dancing in the parade and stopped by the office to celebrate.
I know it's kind of a dark gray day, but seeing that totem and all the beautiful colors on it made me really happy. And it was very moving when we danced around it. And I was choking up because, you know, it's my clan brother is the one who carved that totem pole, Tom Ucas. He's Nanyai like me. We were doing Tlingit dancing. We were doing all kinds of, we had a canoe song. It was an Ishishigune, an ancient canoe song. And then we had the Wrangell coming in song, also known as the Shaman Spirit song. And we did the welcome song. Yeah, to welcome the totem back here. They're really important songs for ceremonies like this, because it brings our ancestors here with us too when we sing them.
The tribal office thanks Paul Chamberlain with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and Greg McCormick with Alaska Marine Lines for their work to bring the totem pole back to Wrangell. The tribal office plans to hold a potluck in mid-September to formally honor the arrival of the totem pole. In Wrangell, I'm Charlotte Duran.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Melody Kay in King Salmon, Sue Dio in Talkeetna, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, and Charlotte Duran in Wrangell. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.